All right, everybody, welcome back for the October Q&A. Happy we get to be together, and it's yours to take away. Go ahead.
So as I ask this question, I want to be clear that I have my reasons for why I would do this, and I'm not asking you to allay any concerns that I have. Please don't give me the rabbinic, this is okay, but today is Halloween in the rest of the world, or at least this country and other parts of Central America. So my question has to do with, specifically maybe to this, but also broadly, how might Jews engage in such holiday cultural practices that are otherwise maybe not so religious anymore, but still have some pretty serious pagan roots? And is that okay? Is that not okay? What are ways of navigating it?
But you don't want a rabbinic answer.
No, I'm saying I already have my reasons. I want a rabbinic answer from you. I don't want the rabbinic approval to make me feel better about what I'm going to do.
It's good to have parameters for these answers. All right. And am I allowed to make you feel worse?
Sure.
Okay. So a little history. My guess is that most people who practice Halloween have no idea that it has a history. This is very different than, for example, Christmas, which people still remember the history of, or Easter, where people remember the history of. And so there's a burden on Jews who want to practice something around Christmas or Easter to try to justify why what they're doing isn't really pertaining to the holiday on whose date and with whose name they're doing. Everyone got that? But Halloween, to the contrary, I don't think anyone remembers what Halloween is originally about. Or that it has a history. I think people are engaging in as close to meaningless frolic as they get. Most people, what Halloween is about wearing costumes and eating candy and being out on the streets if you're in the right neighborhoods. So I personally don't think it's any danger to Judaism at this point to practice to engage in Halloween at that level. When I was a kid, I did Halloween. That was before I got interested in Judaism. But I don't think it's had any ongoing deleterious impact other than continuing festering resentment at my mother, who took away most of the candies after she decided I had had enough. And I'm still bitter about that. The policy out of the kids was that we weren't going to introduce them to Halloween. They had to ask. So at the point that Shira said she wanted to do it, then we said, okay, fine, and we helped her get a costume, and one of us would walk around the streets with her. Jacob always had a way more rational approach to Halloween, which is he didn't understand why you would be traipsing around the street looking for candy if there was a big bowl of it at your front door. So he would just kind of plant himself by the front door, and he would trick-or-treat himself. And I always admired that bold initiative, so I would mostly hang with him. At the other end of the family extreme, my brother Matthew, this is one of the high holy days of the year, and Matthew starts preparing for Halloween about a month and a half in advance. Right after Yom Kippur, he's already thinking. Of all the costumes he's ever worn, and he gets stopped on the street and people have their photos taken with him on Halloween night, in WeHo, which is saying something considerable, because that's where the real Halloween competition happens. His best one was, those of you who remember Rocky and Bullwinkle, he went as Natasha.
Nice.
And so he had to find size 16 men's Mary Janes, which he did. And then he made a Natasha dress, and he had a Natasha wig and stuff. And I think he took 5 years off my father's life by sending him a photograph of himself as Natasha. But he's gone as Severus Snape 1 year, and he's done it really seriously, also indicating that there's absolutely no connection with the practice of Halloween and any of its historical meanings. So I think it's pretty innocent, although this has not been endorsed by the Rabbinical Assembly nor its law committee. I actually don't think they have an opinion on Halloween in writing yet.
So, what happened this past weekend on Saturday in Pittsburgh. I read a quote, and I don't know where it comes from, but it said, God is not only in the tragedy, but can also be found in the response. And I was wondering if you had any words on that line, or what you would say in terms of that quote and how that may
sure.
help. And, yeah.
So the quote, in case people out in cyberspace didn't hear it, is God is not only in the tragedy, but in the response. That's clearly written by someone who hasn't read my book on process theology, because God's not in the tragedy, in my opinion. I think the tragedy, particularly this one, involved a bigoted person who may also have had some mental health issues, who was inflamed by a society that gives overt and covert permission for racism, homophobia, bigotry of all kinds, including anti-Semitism, and he kind of took it on himself to do something about it. So I don't believe that God guided his actions. I don't believe that God made it happen. I think that guy made it happen, and our corrupt society created the fertile ground in which such actions can multiply. But I for sure believe that God is inspiring the responses, of which I assume, like me, you've read dozens and dozens of responses. My friend Rabbi Eli Spitz put up on Facebook a photograph of his synagogue's outer sign, which neighboring non-Jews had put bouquets of flowers on. And people in the neighborhood had written cards and put them by the front door of the synagogue so as not to disturb anybody. They just left cards saying, "We're standing with you, and this is terrible, and not in our neighborhood." And I've heard examples of that all across the country and, frankly, around the world. And I do think there's a way in which it sometimes is as following gross actions of inhumanity that people wake up to realize they have to affirmatively show their humanity, otherwise it becomes occluded. And I definitely see God's love in the courageous love of people in the aftermath of those terrible, terrible moments.
Yeah. Where does hate begin? If love comes from God,
I'm going to answer that on two levels. Where does hate come from if love comes from God? I want to say a little bit stronger than that. I think this is a place where the Gospels get it right. My favorite line in the Gospels is God is love. So I don't think love is just coming from God. I think love is God. I think that in the same way that the book of Genesis lays out that there's tohu vavohu, that God works with for creating, that the hate is tohu vavohu. It's chaos. And it emerges through our own projections of fear and rage, which are just the manifestations of tohu vavohu within us. And I think chaos and cosmos are always wrestling with each other and always duking it out. And there's always chaos to be overcome and won over. And so I think that's where the hate comes from. I think the hate also comes from people's inability to live with their own uncertainty and fear. And one of the ways we falsely try to shore up against fear is by turning it into rage at imagined others. And that's easier than admitting our own frailty and our own uncertainty. And then the last thing I want to say, and this is going to come out in a weird way, because I don't know how else to say it, there's a way in which the anti-Semites and the bigots and the sexists are right. That is to say, their privilege is eroding. Right? So it used to be that straight white men could expect everyone to do it their way, and they could expect disproportionate privilege. And while they should take comfort in the fact that they still have more privilege than they should, they have less than they used to. So they're not wrong to think that these others are eating into what they falsely believe to be theirs. And I want to be clear, it's all for the good that others are coming to the table, and we have a lot more work to do before that becomes anything close to equitable. But the bigots in the world are right to be aware of, they're just responding in the wrong way to the fact that the old privileges are crumbling. And there are those of us who are excited by that possibility and think that that will benefit all of us, but there are people whose narrowly defined self-interest is going to be diminished by that. And I think we need to do two things. We need to more resiliently fight for the world that is coming and that we think should be coming, and we need to try to provide these people with alternative tools for how to respond to their sense of loss. And here I want to offer a key Judaic piece of wisdom. Judaism identifies salvation not primarily with the individual soul, but with the future of the people and of humanity, right? So that the end of days is a communal redemption. I enjoy redemption when we are living in freedom in our own land, and when humanity joins together, one in brotherhood and one in fellowship, said the old prayer book, right? And that vision of a united humanity is a communal geula, a communal redemption. If you define your benefit by the limits of your own skin, what can I get for me? How can I lord it over others as a way of shoring up my own frailty? Then the world we're moving into is terrifying. But if you can define yourself as part of something bigger, then the fact that all will benefit and that the world we're moving into is a world in which all of us can be ourselves and not have to fake being someone we're not, that's a benefit for all of us. And then that, I think, will ultimately help the fears diminish, because then it's a future to be excited about and embrace rather than one to fend off for as long as possible.
I think this is very related to what you were just talking about, but I wanted to ask, why do you think it is specifically that anti-Semitism refuses to die?
Okay, why does anti-Semitism refuse to die? A couple different answers to that. One, anti-Semitism is just one way of people hating other people. And so to the degree that we are one of the oldest unassimilating groups, we have been in a thorn in the side of smothering universalism for thousands of years. I want to unpack that phrase for a minute, right? Universalism, which sounds so benign, often translates into we are all one and there's only one way to do it. So humanity is united so long as you are a human the way I define being a human. And that's how universalism is often packaged. That's Mao Zedong's universalism and Stalin's universalism, and to some degree also Voltaire and Rousseau's universalism. And our tradition has, I think, wisely recognized that the only corrective to that kind of smothering uniformity of universalism is to embrace a really robust particularism in which everybody's distinctiveness is brought to the table, and there's space at the table for everyone's unique way of being and every group's unique way of being. But that's always been unpopular, and we've been doing it longer than others. You know, so the classic births of anti-Semitism are in the Hellenistic period, where everybody else was willing to assimilate into Greek culture, and we just kept saying, wait, we have a couple provisos here. You know that thing about serving pork in the temple to worship pagan gods? Can't do that, right? So, and that provoked an anti-Semitic response. So I think helping people appreciate diversity and difference is part of the remedy to that anti-Semitism, but it continues throughout each age. So in an age in which people mistake capitalism for an ultimate source of values, Jews were by and large saying, well, it's a very useful thing, but it's not where we get our values from. And that made us unpopular. In an age where Marxism was ascendant, we were willing to say there's lots of good things in socialism. We're not willing to turn it into a religion. That made us very unpopular. Or in America, where there were Jewish communists who were saying that kind of radical egalitarianism is exactly what we need as a corrective to the racism and the excesses of capitalism here, and that made us unpopular here. So I think there are new masks that anti-Semitism wears in every age. I don't think it's separate from the way people castigate and diminish groups that they feel are alien. And Jews continue to be distinctive, and we continue to be different. And then I want to say something overtly religious and maybe mystical as well. Just as there's something unique about Jewish history, we are the ever-dying people, but other nations rise and fall and disappear, and somehow we keep going. We're the only nation I know that were in exile throughout most of our history, lacking all of the props by which cultures maintain themselves, and then somehow 1,500 years later, we go back to our land and we reestablish the old language. Nobody does that. And so I'm not surprised when I see disproportionate hate of Israel or disproportionate rage at the Jews. There's a way in which our tradition has explained to us we're kind of God's ambassadors in the world. And that means that the rage people have towards God gets displaced onto us, right? You can't throw a rock through God's windows, but you can throw it through ours. And we kind of remind people by our very presence of really inconvenient things, you know, like the dignity of labor and the equality of all people and the need for sanctifying time and for letting the fields lie fallow. And like, there's just a whole lot of burdens that we represent. And so to a humanity that wants to live an irresponsible and carefree life, we point out you can do one or the other. And that the paradox is the way to live as carefree a life as possible is to take responsibility. But nobody likes to hear that. And so in our religious and in our secular modes, we Jews keep teaching that. And I think a lot of people resent it. And then the last thing I want to say, and again, I'm not sure we're supposed to say this publicly, but there is something really utterly striking and shocking about the degree and diversity of Jewish success. And that's not to say that there aren't Jewish poor people, and it's not to say there aren't mediocre Jews. I have met many of you. I meant them. But it is also true that we are 0.03 of humanity, and if you look at the number of people who are Nobel Prize winners and MacArthur winners and Supreme Court justices and senators and playwrights and novelists and poets and art, like, it is breathtakingly weird how many of them are Jews and how utterly out of proportion that is. And I'm not sure I have a rational explanation for why it is, but it is striking. And I imagine some people find it disturbing. And that may contribute to anti-Semitism too. And the last thing I want to say is, I think in this country, one of the most dangerous parts of the heritage of anti-Semitism is the way we have internalized it and the way we take upon ourselves to police how Jewish we let ourselves be. And that's the internalized sickness that anti-Semitism provokes, in much the same way that people police their own gender identities or expressiveness, or they police their own degree of racial identification. And I think that A, never works. It's not a way to buy off the anti-Semites. And B, all it does is it spreads the virus by accepting it. So I think one of the things we have to do in the light of an age of labeling and hate is to not internalize it and to be as Jewish and how Jewish we choose to be without reference to what other people respond to it.
I wonder also if part of our modern anti-Semitism has to do, or comes from kind of the more liberal side, looking at Israel and the injustices that the Israeli government puts on some of its citizens. I wonder if you think that some of the modern anti-Semitism comes from there also.
Well, so look, let me try to requalify the language and then I can answer it. I don't think that modern anti-Semitism comes from policies of the Israeli government. Right? I do think that modern anti-Semites sometimes hide behind their dislike of Israeli politics to justify anti-Semitism, or they allow their criticisms of Israel to slide into anti-Semitism because it's a way to slide into anti-Semitism. One can be critical of the policies of the Israeli government without despising Jews. Right? I want to go further than that. You know, I don't know anybody who's not critical of some of the policies of any government. But to go from I'm critical of some policies to the entire state is illegitimate, that does look to me like an anti-Semitic slide, but it's not caused by Israel, it's caused by being an anti-Semite. And then Israel becomes the window dressing for the anti-Semitism, right? You know, you can dislike a policy of the French government without making broad castigations of all French people or all French culture, or saying, because I don't like something the French government is doing, we should get rid of France, which sounds crazy, doesn't it? I mean, to say that, but people think it doesn't sound crazy when they're talking about Israel. And so I think our job is to moderate that, of course, Israel as a vibrant democracy is strong enough to benefit from a healthy debate. And being constructively critical of Israeli policies with which you differ or which you think are harmful, that's part of being a contributing member of any democracy, right? The emphasis here is on constructive criticism. But that has nothing to do with the slide into evaluating the Jewish people, right? Or because someone doesn't like something Israel's doing, they're going to try to attack a Jew in Pittsburgh, as if that's a reasonable response. No, that's both criminal and nutty, and we need to be able to keep calling it that. Well, somebody should go first. We knew she was going to win that one, you know. That was a noble battle on your part.
I have a question inspired by something Natasha actually asked earlier before the Q&A. It's, what would you say to, I guess, the family now of the newborn whose public entrance into this world is marred by such blood and hate? And what would you say to that kid 20, 30 years from now?
So, look, what would I say to a baby born today? To the family of the baby.
The breast
the baby.
Going on.
The one who's being named.
In Pittsburgh.
The Pittsburgh
child.
Baby.
Pittsburgh, yes. The child who is having their having his bit his breasts and when the monster.
If I were a rabbi to the family there, in addition to just sitting and holding hands and crying together a lot, and in addition to giving room for them to be enraged that their happy moment was taken, I think we all have a struggle to not allow bad experiences to harden into grudges, right? And so they can choose whether they want to focus on they have a beautiful baby who is the best possible answer to an anti-Semite, or they can focus on the fact that that moment was taken. But the meaning of their baby was only taken if they let it be. And that's true for all of us. We get to decide whether the tragedies or the bumps in the road are going to become an obsessive focus and define us forever, or whether we're going to say, no, that's a negative experience, and I'm not going to let it have real estate in my heart. So my work with that family would be to say, you cannot let those first moments define the baby except in the following way. Your baby is a hero and a survivor. And your baby is walking evidence that the anti-Semites can slow us down, but they can't stop us. And that's the lesson you need to teach your baby every day of your baby's life. And 20 years from now, I would repeat that. You are the child who lived, you know? And so I expect you to bring down the Voldemorts of your time, just as he did the ones of his.
I hope they understand the metaphor in 20 years from
now. Oh, they will. They will.
On a similar note of Saturday, I think one of the most beautiful things on Saturday is seeing the outpouring of support from other communities, many of them marginalized in their own right. What are some ways that, in light of or not in light of, we can authentically mobilize the Jewish community to stand up in true solidarity on other issues?
Okay, so let's talk about the support we received from other communities and how important that was for us and what that should do for us. I'm sure I wasn't the only one in this room who, when the events were unfolding and I heard several Jews talk about this as a wake-up call, thinking there are a lot of people in this country for whom this isn't a wake-up call, it's just another day with another bigot. So the fact that American Jews have been relatively sheltered on a direct level from these kinds of assaults should not blind us to the fact that there are communities for whom this is every day. You know, the same day that those Jews were being shot, there was a black church getting shot at by a white supremacist, which did not make it into the news. And that should be alarming to us, because these acts aren't separate, right? And hatred is ultimately not divisible. And someone creating a culture in which people are at license to express their hatred will ultimately drown all of us. So I want to make two arguments for the Jewish community. One is, it is in our self-interest to be at the forefront of resisting bigotry and violence. But I also want to make a deeper argument, which is, it's a matter of our own integrity that we stand in the world not merely for our own thriving and survival, but that Judaism understands that we are stewards and caretakers for the rest of creation, which means everybody's well-being is our business. And a world that doesn't allow people to thrive, that's an assault against Jewish values, if not Jewish interest. So I hope that what comes out of this is that Jews remember how good it feels to not be alone. And then the next time they see someone assaulted or they read of some group assaulted, they take that lesson and apply it outward. And now I want to say one other thing. It's not either or. I think given our socioeconomic status, Jews have been more engaged in other people's struggles for justice than many other comparable groups. It's just not enough. So I don't want this to be a chance to castigate Jews as bad guys. I want to say we've been not good enough guys, and we can do better. And that doing better is both of practical self-benefit, but it also is a coming home to our own integrity and who we're called to be.
I'm not sure if
but I've encountered some people, perhaps on the right wing, who are insistent on not politicizing this, and saying that, like, okay, anti-Semitism has always been around, it will be, and this isn't a political thing, and then continue to defend the current administration. And
all right, so I have actually multiple thoughts about the charge of not politicizing. I'm afraid that by the end of this, I'll be unpopular with every possible political sector represented in the room. That doesn't necessarily mean I'm right, although it's a good indication that I probably am. So here's the thing. When people say don't politicize, they're assuming that it's not political until you make a political connection. But everything is political. People treating other people is political, and this emerges in a particular context, which reflects a particular politics as well. But how you read the politicization is always a measure of where you sit politically, right? Meaning someone whose proclivities and understandings are more center-right, they'll politicize this in a very different way than someone who's center-left, which is going to be very different than someone who's far-right or far-left. So the issue isn't politicize or not politicize. The issue is what's reasonable political deductions to make from something. And here, I guess I want to say, there are two levels of challenge. One is, I think there have been not so subtle dog whistles from the very top that have indicated that the anti-Semites and the racists and the homophobes can take off their white robes and go out in the streets now. And so the jump in hate crimes didn't just happen. It happened because of a larger environment. And that I don't understand why everyone isn't shouting about across the political spectrum, meaning you can support the political policies of either party, but not tolerate bigotry and crassness and vulgarity. And that I wish I would see more of across the board. The second thing, though, that's also part of it, here's where I'm going to alienate the people who liked what I said thus far, is there is this fascist notion that you obliterate the distinction between the political and the personal. So that if you don't like someone's politics, you can harass them in their personal lives, and that's justified by how much you don't like their politics. And that will be the death of democracy, right? So you heard it from me here. If members of Trump's cabinet can't go out for dinner in a restaurant, then when the Democrats retake the White House, you lose the ability to criticize when our people can't go out to dinner. And then all we're going to have is nobody going out to dinner. Right? I don't see how that makes the world a better place. So democracy requires us to create a wall between personal lives and political positions. And I know you think this is worse than ever, and therefore, in this case, we should not do that. But the next time your people hold power, there will be someone equally offended in the other side who will use that very argument to do things that you will then say are intolerable. So I think part of the crassness of our time is we have anything goes. And for the sake of politics, you can say anything, do anything, and the integrity of your convictions and their strength justifies anything. That will kill our democracy. So there has to be an assertion on the left, on the right, and on the center that we can have vociferous arguments of content that do not cross over into the personal. And there has to be a kind of sacred space for the personal across the line. Otherwise, there will be no end to it. All right. Thanks, everybody. I appreciate the chance to have this conversation together.